We have six matters on the calendar, the first three orally, and we proceed first with the matter State of Minnesota versus Murtada Ahmed Abdurrahim. And as council is aware, 15 minutes for each party, 5 minutes for appellant to respond. And as soon as you're ready, you may proceed. Make sure to identify yourself for the record when you do approach the podium.
Good morning, Your Honors. David Lebo. I represent appellant Murtada Ahmed Abdurrahim. May it please the court, counsel. The laws against prostitution in this state are broad, but they are not unlimited, and they are not so broad as to cover the conduct at issue here. At the district court and in its briefing, the state has focused on Mr. Abdurrahim's intent. We submit, however, that this is a red herring, and the question instead is whether there is a sufficient actus reus here to justify a conviction.
I'm just going to interrupt, Rep. Counsel. Can the marshal hit the timer, please? Thank you.
In its closing at the district court, the state seemed to argue that some combination of the words Mr. Abdurrahim used and their effect on the complainant made the statement an offer rather than something preliminary to an offer, as Mr. Abdurrahim argued below. In its rebuttal, the state explicitly asked the jury to consider what Mr. Abdurrahim's intent and plan was and to consider what he was going to do. All of this misled the jury and distracted it from the key question of whether what Mr. Abdurrahim said was an offer, either explicitly or implicitly, as we acknowledge the law allows. In our brief, we gave the court a couple of different approaches that it could choose to take to answer this question. But whether from a formal contractual perspective or from a less formal, more practical perspective, there simply is no offer here required to sustain a conviction under the prostitution patronage statutes. Perhaps the clearest manifestation of this issue is to ask what the quid of this offer would have been. The quo was sex. There's no dispute there. But what was it that was going to be exchanged? Was it some unspecified amount of money? What amount of money would that have been? There's no answer to that in the record. What if the complainant had been willing to have sex for free? That is a possibility from what the record discloses, but...
aren't you making awful light of the question, how much? Are you suggesting that there actually has to be a price negotiated in order to satisfy the mens rea?
Your Honor, the rule that we are suggesting, and there really isn't anything that we've been able to find in the case law on this question, the rule that we're suggesting is that an offer to hire would need to have something that leaves no further significant negotiation. So asking how much offers a few possible answers. One is it's not for sale. And this, in the prostitution context, that's why we're here, obviously, but in any context in which something is for sale or might be for sale, it could be it's not for sale, it could be it's free, which would potentially take it outside the realm of the prostitution laws entirely, or there could be a price. And if there were a price, that would itself be an offer, and that could be accepted, rejected, and that would lead to its own sort of tree of potential outcomes under the criminal law. But here, we're talking about a question that was preliminary to an offer. If the answer had been, it's not for sale, well, there would have been nothing left to negotiate, presumably.
Well, the statute says offers to hire. It doesn't require an acceptance.
No, it doesn't. But to offer requires some... And we cite civil contract case law. It requires something that leaves something to be said yes or no to. And that's our proposed rule here, is that someone could say yes, no, counteroffer. You know, there are a few different things that, that could be responded to, but here it wouldn't have made sense if the complainant had said yes or no. The question was, you know, how much for sex? And so there's something that is left to be determined there before there can be an offer under our interpretation of that word in the statute.
Mr. Lebo, did the trial court properly give the instructions, the jury instructions, at least the pattern jury instructions for this statute? And assuming so, would you not be asking this court to essentially create new law? I mean, wouldn't that be as a matter of law, those instructions would be defective if we adopted your contract language?
The trial court, as I recall, did give the pattern jury instruction over Mr. Abdelrahim's counsel's request to define offer. Again, I've looked, and his prior counsel looked. He's had two prior counsel at the trial court, and no one, and the state, I imagine, has looked as well, and nobody's really found that this court or the Supreme Court has ever defined offer in this context. So the pattern jury instruction really regurgitates the statute, which is fine in the absence of case law, but there is a preserved issue there, and you know, offer may need to be defined further in the jury instructions in the case law.
Would that be then consistent with the law or the suggestion that since it's not defined, but it's a term for which lay people could commonly understood, that was what the jury is able to do by the jury instructions, just make their determination factually whether beyond a reasonable doubt an offer had been made by the conduct?
Well, I think I don't have a great answer to that. I think it goes to the sufficiency of the evidence challenge, and you know, is there enough to constitute an offer, you know, from a perspective that takes into account the fact that the jury, you know, the state suggested to the jury that, again, Mr. Abdelrahim's intent was sort of the primary question there, rather than what he said. And I mean, the court can review the record there, but. My read of the closing argument and the rebuttal is that there was a real focus there on what he had meant to do, what he would have done, rather than whether these words themselves constituted an offer. That was something that Mr. Abdelrahim's counsel did bring up. But in rebuttal, again, the state focused on...
Well, closing arguments and rebuttal of counsel, that's not evidence. We always tell the jurors... What counsel says is not evidence. The jurors heard what was said, what the response was. Aren't they in the position that they are able to draw reasonable inferences from that?
Well, perhaps. On the other hand, this is a sufficiency of the evidence challenge based on circumstantial evidence, and this court gets to decide what is a reasonable inference and what is not in that context. So our position here is that the jury's verdict is not subject to deference. Given the issue as far as you know, what is an offer here.
After speaking with the first woman, your client approached a second individual near Soldiers Field Park and asked how much. She replies for what? He replies for sex. You're arguing sufficiency of the evidence. This to me appears to be an offer for hire.
Well, it's preliminary to an offer for hire. We're not going to...
Why preliminary?
Because there is...
What does offer mean? Doesn't mean that the deal closes.
It means that there's something to say yes or no to. If I were to...
I think that's for what? And he says for sex. That's something to say yes or no to.
Well, except that the question is how much?
No. For what? He says how much? Then she says for what? And then he says, for sex. So let's keep him in that order.
And I think the latter question...
You know the what, because he answers, for sex.
Yes. But I think that question has to relate back to the earlier question, and the question is, what's being offered?
Well, he says, for sex. Because she says, what, for what?
And that's the the quo. But what's the quid? What is the thing that is being offered for sex?
And that's what I hear you arguing is that because the dollar amount wasn't settled, that it doesn't meet the four corners of a contract. But this isn't contract litigation. We're talking a criminal offense. And I look at the statute under which he's charged, and it says offer to hire. It doesn't say sign contract, notarize, signatures. So in connection with your argument, what's the strongest point you have as far as the sufficiency of the evidence?
That offer, that there is not enough sufficient, there's not enough evidence here to create an offer.
But I guess what I'm asking, is that because the price was not determined?
It's because, it sort of boils down to that at some level, I suppose. But what it really comes to is that there was nothing to say yes or no to. And I think that's necessary for an offer here. When we're talking about, real estate, to put it in a somewhat different, perhaps analogous perspective, if I say, is that house for sale, that isn't an offer. How much is that house isn't an offer.
That's not criminal to solicit a house.
No, so, but
you're comparing civil requirements, contract being on all fours, with criminal requirements. And that's where I think you're off the point of what I'm trying to ask is what was missing about this offer.
Well, and in a context in which offer is not defined, even for lay people, did you put in an offer on that house? Did you offer to buy that item at a garage sale? And that's why we have these dual approaches in our brief of contract law, or sort of more plain language approach. In none of those contexts would how much is that, or is it for sale, be an offer. It's just not definite enough. And that's what the contract law approach and that more pragmatic approach share, is there has to be something reasonably definite. I think the language, and that's in the record, and we're not contesting that for the purpose of the appeal here, but that language really does boil down to, is it for sale and how much? And that is not just definite enough to be an offer, even leaving aside the sort of more formalistic contract law approach.
Are you asking us to ignore the Supreme Court's language in State v. Bennett, in which the court said that the offer need not be expressed or in the language of the statute, but may be implied from the words and actions of the defendant taken in context?
No, Your Honor, we're not asking to ignore that, and we think that this rule would be would dovetail with that. If there are circumstances such that, for example, how much, trying to think of an example here that would make some sense. If there were some verbal expression with sort of similar to this, but there was some dollar amount implied by the offeror, that would probably be sufficient. And that would be a different situation than here, where there is no evidence that this is anything other than something preliminary to an offer. And the dollar amount or sort of the quid would come from the complainant. So those are not divergent approaches. There might be a little bit of tension there. Again, I'm not thinking of a great example that would sort of make sense just on the spot here, but no, those are not by any means inconsistent.
Mr. Leibold, so is your point, just to clarify then, only those cases in which, to use our situation, if he asks, are you free and for what, to have sex, the only way a conviction would occur is if he says, will you have sex with me for $100?
No, Your Honor. We think that this rule would be broader than that. Again, it can be implied, and it often is implied in the case law and the experience, I think, of trial judges. but it needs to be something other than sort of the wink-wink, you know, are you a prostitute? Because I think read a little bit more broadly, the idea that the state puts forward here, both in the district court and its briefing, says, are you a prostitute, could well be an offer to hire. You know, read with just a little bit of implicit, you know, I'm not asking because I'm, you know, going to arrest you if you say yes, I'm going to, you know, make an offer. There has to be something preliminary to that offer. It can't be that the offer sort of springs forth fully grown here with that idea. So, again, that rule would give some certainty to the idea of you know, offer to hire as being this completely undefined phrase. I will spend just about 10 seconds asking the court also to consider the Spriegel issue. This is not an immediate episode evidence. There is no causal relationship. And the prejudice, I think, is clear because of the witnesses. The first witness, talked only about this prior bad act evidence. The officer talked kind of half and half about this. And fully half of the exhibits addressed the prior bad act evidence. So we are asking the court primarily to reverse outright, but also to reverse and remand for a new trial if the Spriegel evidence is wrongly admitted. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for respondent, you may proceed.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jennifer Plant, and I represent the state of Minnesota in this matter. I'm here today to respectfully request that you affirm the district court and find that appellant was in fact guilty of the crime as charged, first by finding that there was more than sufficient evidence to uphold the jury's verdict, and second, to find that the district court acted well within its discretion when it decided to allow in evidence of the interaction between the appellant and LP under the immediate episode exception. Additionally, even if the court finds that the district court was in error when it admitted in that evidence under the immediate episode exception, the state would suggest that under 404B, this also would have been evidence that would have been admissible as evidence of motive, intent, knowledge, and also identity. So either way, the court did not err or abuse its discretion when it allowed in that evidence. First, Judge Sleater, to answer your question, yes, the trial court did ask the jury to apply its everyday understanding of what the word offer means. That's at the trial transcript on page 268, lines 1 and 2. Counsel for appellant below did ask to have the word offer further defined, and she declined to do so and asked that the jury simply apply their everyday understanding of what that word means. Secondly, with respect to Mr. Lebo's focus on the state's closing argument and their focus on the intent of the appellant versus the language that the appellant used, and this goes to your point, Judge Werke, obviously the arguments of counsel are not evidence, so that's irrelevant when you're talking about a sufficiency of the evidence claim, which we are here, at least with respect to the first issue. Also, Judge Werke, that dovetails nicely with my main point here is that we really are here to address whether or not there was sufficient evidence to sustain the jury's verdict. This is not a question of statutory interpretation. This is not a time for the court to decide whether or not we need to address new jury instructions for what it means to make an offer to hire someone to engage in sexual contact or sexual penetration. This is a claim that there is insufficient evidence to sustain the verdict of guilty that the jury returned after listening to two witnesses who were approached by appellant in the same public park within 30 minutes of one another, and then also heard the officer who responded to both of these women's calls for assistance, and then the jury returned a verdict of guilty after hearing these three witnesses as well as the two audio recordings that were made of these women calling dispatch, asking for assistance after having been approached by appellant in that public Park. Now, it's the state's position that this is sufficient evidence, not giving any deference necessarily to the jury's findings since this is a circumstantial case, but viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the verdict, which the court is supposed to do, there is no other rational hypothesis other than that appellant was in the public park trying to find someone with whom he could engage in sex in exchange for money. The intent of the appellant is clear from his language. The court is allowed to look at his intent as well as the circumstance, the totality of the circumstances of the interactions with the victim in this case, AF. As Judge Werke identified, there was an exchange of how much for what, for sex, and not only was there this limited exchange of the back and forth without ascertaining a price, but after the victim informed the appellant that she was not interested in this, counsel himself in his brief pointed out that appellant continued to try to convince the victim to engage in sexual contact or penetration with him for money. Now, if this does not constitute an offer under Minnesota statutes, applying the plain language of the word offer, I'm not sure what does. Perhaps you could even argue that he at this point had hired her, although she is declining his offer. I'm not going to go down that road, even though I opened it up. That was unfortunate. At any rate, I do not think that there's any question that there is sufficient evidence in this case to sustain or affirm the jury's verdict. Again, the key phrase here is rational hypothesis. There is no rational hypothesis here other than that of guilt. It is not rational to think that the appellant was in the park to simply suss out whether or not there are people who might be available, A, to be hired in general, and B, to be hired for prostitution in particular. It is not rational to think that the appellant was wandering around the park in the second instance and driving around the park in the first instance trying to find someone to whom he could invite to make an offer to engage in sexual contact or sexual penetration in broad daylight in a public park in the middle of the city of Rochester. Moving on to the admission of the evidence of the witness LP, the immediate episode exception is allowed under 404B if there is both a temporal connection as well as a causal connection. As stated earlier, these two interactions with the different women occurred within about 30 minutes of one another, so although there's nothing directly on point in the cases about how much time or how little enough time is there to establish a temporal connection, I would say that here it's been established, and I don't believe that counsel disputes that or identified that as the crux of his argument in his brief. So more importantly, we're looking at the causal connection, and here we do have that causal connection. Case law regarding the immediate episode exception has focused on three primary factors or potential ways to show a causal connection. First and foremost, which is what the district court relied upon here, is that there needs to be a pursuit of a single criminal objective. And that's what the appellant herein was doing. He was driving around and then walking around trying to find someone with whom he could engage in either sexual contact or sexual penetration in exchange for money. Now, that's the single criminal objective. We also have this immediate episode being established with a causal connection by the appellant gaining information from his first interaction and the contested evidence here in order to better perpetrate the offense in his second interaction. He realized after engaging with the witness LP that staying in his car and beckoning to a strange woman and asking her to get in was not the right way to go about hiring someone for sex. So instead of doing that with the second woman, he parked his vehicle, got out of the car, and decided to approach her on foot. So under that analysis, you also have the causal connection that's been established. And then we also have case law that supports the idea that the evidence can be admitted in and shows a causal connection when the evidence of the prior interaction under the immediate episode analysis escalated into the offense that was charged. Here, again, we have a relatively innocuous interaction with the appellant and the witness LP where he's sitting within the confines of his vehicle. She accidentally approaches him thinking it's her mother in the parking lot, realizes that's not my mom, starts to turn to walk away when she realizes that this person does not need help and that his vehicle's not disabled, and then has to, in her words, tell him off because he's beckoning her to get into the car and she's already already told him once, "I'm not getting in your car, dude," and yet he still tries to convince her that she should come with him in his vehicle. And after that, he then actually proceeds to somewhat follow her as she's walking on foot while he's in her vehicle, to the point that she diverts her path from her originally intended location at the Walmart where she wanted to cash her check, and instead goes to a gas station so she can call the police because she's frightened. So after this first interaction with witness LP, the appellant says, I guess it's not a good idea to try and get women to get into my car. And he uses this information, and not only does he use the information, but now his behavior's escalating because he's not gotten what he's wanted. So now his behavior escalates to the point where he's not just asking strange women in the middle of broad daylight at a public park to get into his car, he's actually approaching them on foot, standing in front of their path, blocking is the word that the victim used in this case, rendering her unable to proceed, and then engaging with her directly, or at least more directly than the conversation or the gesturing to LP, and saying, "How much for what? Sex. How much for sex?"
Ms. The witness, can I inquire, assuming that there's the causal connection, would it still not be appropriate for the court to do a 403, assuming that it's admissible, but the prejudicial effect of it? And did the court do that in this case? And the reason I'm asking is, especially given the perhaps admittedly, although from your client's standpoint, sufficient evidence, still admittedly somewhat vague conversation, arguably, did not the jury obviously rely heavily on that immediate episode evidence as opposed to focus on the incident that led to the conviction?
I think there are two questions there, Judge. The first is that I don't recall off the top of my head whether the court prior to trial engaged in a particularly strong analysis of whether this evidence would be prejudicial. She focused really on the immediate episode exception and the fact that there was a singular criminal objective here. With respect to what the jury did or did not rely on, again, LP's testimony was limited greatly to what happened with her. She never referenced that there was any conversation about sex. She never referenced knowing anything about what had happened after the fact. She just was able to provide the jury with a picture of what had happened about 30 minutes prior to the interaction between appellant and the victim herein. That picture was that appellant was in the area, not just in the area, but at Soldiers Field Park at the right time, on the right day. It was the same man with the same vehicle. And as it so happens, the same officer responded to both LP and AF because, in his words, he got a second call about similar conduct in the same place, was already there, and therefore was dispatched to respond to the second incident. So, of course, I don't have a crystal ball into what the jury was or wasn't relying on here when they returned a verdict of guilty, but given the relatively limited testimony of witness LP and the rather lengthy testimony of the victim AF herein, and also the audio recordings of both of those two people, I can only speculate, unfortunately, that the jury relied primarily on AF's testimony, again, because the question before the jury is he guilty of asking AF whether she wanted to give him sex in exchange for money. And what the jury heard her say was, it was quite clear what he was asking. And she not only stated that to the state on multiple occasions when asked directly, what did he ask you? He asked me if I would have sex with him for money. What did he ask you? He said he would pay me. And what did he say he would pay you for? This interrogation between the state's attorney and the victim, AF, goes on for, relatively speaking, a fairly long amount of time. That's the bulk of the testimony. We also have the audio recording where AF says the same thing to the police officer. This guy just asked me if he could pay me for sex in the park. It's hard to get something more compelling than the audio recording of the victim making that statement to the dispatcher within mere minutes after it's happening, and then having that bolstered by her own in-person testimony. She was fearful. She was timid. They had to ask her to speak up. This goes to her credibility. The jury is seeing all this play out. I personally, when having read the transcript, found AF's testimony far more compelling credible than anything else that was before the jury. So no, I don't think that the admission of LP's testimony and the audio recording of her call to dispatch would have been prejudicial, because the most damaging evidence in this case was AF's testimony. That being said, I believe I've covered everything at this point, so unless the court has further questions, the state will rest on its brief.
Very well. Thank you, counsel. Appellant, may you respond if you wish?
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, the state continues to focus on the unseemliness of the behavior here. That isn't what is at issue. We're not asking the court to find that this wasn't unseemly, wasn't related in some way to some, you know, attempt to hire for sex. We're not asking the court, of course, to ratify this behavior. This might have been another crime. My disorderly conduct comes to mind, but that was not what was charged. The question is this sufficient based on the conviction sufficient based on the evidence elicited at trial? The state is focused, again, fairly heavily, including today, on Mr. Abdelrahim's intent. Intent is necessary here, but it is not sufficient. There needs to be evidence of an offer. I believe Judge Shellhas had asked me about the tension between the idea of an implicit, the implicit potential nature of an offer. And I've got an example that I thought of during Ms. Plante's argument, which is, for example, you know, take the facts here but with someone having a $100 bill in their hand. And the idea is, you know, can I hire you for sex waving around a $100 bill? There's an amount there. There's something definite that there is something to be said yes or no to. And here, the court would need to ratify this this sort of gap between, you know, can I, you know, how much for sex, to some kind of yes, no. And it's our contention, again, that there has to be something definite enough to leave aside further significant negotiation about what is being offered and what is being obtained. And, you know, particularly, the implicit nature of an offer, it seems to me, is often going to rest on the quo rather than the quid here. The quid, you know, being money, presumably, and the quo being sex. You know, often it's that the sex part that's left, at least not explicitly said. There are fewer cases where it's the money that is left a little bit less explicit. But that is the case here. And while a jury is in a perhaps a better place to find an implicit offer that it's sex rather than something else that's trying to be obtained, here there is something of a legal question between, again, that preliminary inquiry and a completed offer. So unless the court has other questions, I would yield the rest of my time.
Very well. It appears not. Thank you, counsel. Thank you both, counsel, for your arguments and the briefing. We'll take the matter under advisement. Have a good day.